The market doesn't joke around, so why would you? Get serious. Choose Tastytrade. Tastytrade gives you the tools you need to make smarter moves. Dig into data with advanced charting, track profit accurately with order chain trackers, see risk clearly with curve analysis, and trade with low-capped commissions, stocks, options, futures, and more. All on one platform. No wonder serious traders choose Tastytrade. Join the club, genius. Tasty Trading is a registered broker-dealer and member of FINRA and SIPC.
I'm Scott Wapner, and you're listening to CNBC's Halftime Report, the podcast, the most profitable hour of the trading day. We record this live weekdays at 12 Eastern. Listen in.
Welcome to the Halftime Report. I'm Scott Wapner. Front and center this hour, stimulus hopes dimming, virus cases rising, stocks are selling off. What to do with your money right now? We debate that with our investment committee. With me today for the hour, Josh Brown, Steve Weiss, Jim Labenthal, and Liz Young, BNY Mellon's Director of Market Strategy, a CNBC contributor. Good to see everybody. Let's check the markets as we always do. Stocks are pacing for their third straight negative session. Liz, is this all about stimulus, or are we genuinely concerned about these cases we're seeing in Europe? And oh, by the way, we're doing a lot of cases here every day, too.
I don't think it's all about stimulus, but we're in the middle of a really heavyweight news cycle, and it's not allowing us to look out really any further than about 30 days at a time. And I think ultimately, in 30 days' time, the market is lower than it is today. And here's why. If you look at just on Monday, the S&P was up 5% month to date. That didn't make common sense. We're in the middle of a highly contentious election season. The market does not typically rally through a new White House, and the pandemic isn't over. And we're still waiting for stimulus. So in the short term, I think we should see a pullback here. But in the longer term, and even in the next 3 to 4 months, I think some of the fear around a blue wave has been a little overblown. And the market has to weigh the two sides of that. On one side, we might see higher taxes and stronger regulations. On the other side, we're going to see probably a huge fiscal package. And some of the tariffs maybe be rolled back. And at the end of the day, I think that second side wins. So the answer is, as an investor, even if we have a pullback in the short term, you don't do anything about it because you're not going to put money back on the table soon enough to catch a rally on the other side.
Josh, is that what we're looking at, a market pulling back over the next 30 days or so? And then if that happens, what should the investor do?
I'm not sure because I'm not sure that that's what we're looking at per se, because investors are very good at processing information and then moving on with their lives. We have seen the resilience of the investor desire to get to the next news cycle rather than dwelling on the current one time after time after time. And this year is a great example of that. I think there's a bigger story playing out, though, right now, which is in shares of Fastly. And this is not an important company, but what's happening to its share price is very important. And I'll explain why as concisely as I can. Fastly is not even in the S&P 500. Why? They don't earn any money, can't be in. But it's an important stock because it's part of a group of stocks that have captured the imagination of investors, especially this new class of investors that have come to dominate the daily trading in the market this year. And what's happening with Fastly, I think, is serving as both cautionary tale and possibly canary in the coal mine for a lot of the type of speculative activity we've seen in NASDAQ names. So this is a company that basically said, instead of coming in with $73 million in revenue for one quarter, they're going to come in with $71 million. And Wall Street took 30% off its market cap after that. Mm-hmm. Now, anyone that runs a business knows that if you do $71 million and not $73 million, it's really not that big of a deal. But that is a sign of how much investors had been bidding these stocks up and how unrealistic the expectations of perfection have been. And I think you're seeing a lot of names that are similar in terms of who owns them, mm-hmm. selling off in sympathy. And this is the type of thing that could really snowball. So that's on my radar today, okay, more so than the back and forth over stimulus.
I'm glad it is because it's on mine. And I do think when you have a stock that's up 360% year to date, and your point is so well taken, as Jim Cramer said this morning, normally, $73 million to $71 million, not a big deal. But when your stock is up that much and your valuation is as big, Steve, as Fastly's is, 73 better not be 71. It better be 81. And that's the point that Jim made. Josh took the words out of my mouth with was going to ask you guys if you think this is a canary in the coal mine, if we are going to be looking back at this moment and saying Fastly tipped the scale against a lot of these stocks that have run up a lot. Cloudflare, 233%. Zscaler, 226%. Wayfair, 222%. DocuSign, 218%. Twilio, 228%. And on and on and on.
It's not in my consciousness today. I could care less about Fastly. And I'll tell you this, that if companies come out, even if we see, you know, the most recent come out, the ones that are more egregiously overvalued, and print a number better than expectation, everybody's going to forget Fastly. So I don't really care about it. What I care about is I care about stimulus, which will happen, maybe not in this time frame that we're looking for before the election or that Trump's looking for, but I think the market's comfortable with it happening after the election. We saw a minor impact yesterday after a big move, that 5% move earlier in the week. We saw a minor move yesterday when the Mnuchin comments came out about a deal not happening. My bigger concern is the virus. We're seeing a spike in the vast majority of states here. We're seeing the temporary hospitals put up again in Wisconsin. We're seeing Europe locking down. Now, I don't think we locked down, but when I look at the cold weather coming in and seeing restaurants, at least in the East, maybe not in California, but in the East, they'll be shutting. People aren't going to be going out. That feeds through the supply chain. That's a much bigger issue. And one of the reasons why I started reducing exposure yesterday. Haven't sold anything today because I think we'll recover. But to me, that's the bigger issue. Look, Fastly, yeah, maybe the Robinhood crowd, but I could care less what they do.
I don't disagree with you necessarily that the bigger picture issues are looming larger for the overall market than a 30 or 25 or 30% decline in a Fastly. But don't you agree, Steve, that this is a call, perhaps, to take a look at some of these stocks and realize that even as a Zoom has deserved in some respects to have a great run because of everybody using it, it's become part of our lexicon, that maybe 682% year to date is something to take a second look at. Or a Peloton. Yes, we know why it's up, but 373% year to date, Steve. So a Fastly just sort of raises your eyebrows and said, you know what? Maybe some of these stocks, as great as the companies are, have gone way too far, way too fast. And if there's a big, you know, pop of the air bubble there, that a lot of those names could come down by a lot. And that's going to affect the psyche in the overall market.
No, I don't disagree with that, that some of these names are egregiously overvalued. I own Peloton. I think it's vastly overvalued, but the market hasn't cared about valuation for a while. If it has, we wouldn't be at the levels we're at.
No, but that's
our
point.
What the market cares about.
That's our point. Is it now going to start caring? Did Fastly just ring the bell?
No.
And say, now you better start caring about valuations?
Let me ask you this. If Snowflake comes out and reports a better number than the few analysts that have it, that follow it, have, or if Peloton comes out and reports a better number than they guided, do you think people will remember Fastly? Do you think they'll sell stocks? It's all about momentum of execution. It's not about valuation. Now, my portfolio is largely
based on valuation fundamentals. It's about expectations too, Jim.
Missing the point.
The Fastly's going up by the magnitude of which they did. I need to hear from Jim Labenthal, Josh first. Is it just raises the bar? Like Jim Cramer said this morning, 73 million can't go to 71 million. It has to be 81 million to justify the move in the stock that Josh mentioned.
It's absolutely true. I mean, look, the jury is still out whether today is the bell ringing or not. I mean, let's put this into perspective. In the last 3 months, this is the fourth drawdown just in Fastly of 20% or greater. So when you get in this rarefied air, these things are going to happen. But here's, I think, the more important point. Let's say this is the ringing of the bell for Fastly and the software stocks and some of these new economy stocks. I don't think that has to be contagious to the rest of the market. In fact, I emphatically think it does not have to be contagious. I look at the Apples, the Googles, the Microsofts of the world, all three of which I own, roughly 30 times forward earnings, and I say in this interest rate environment and with the secular growth they've got, they are perfectly fine at that valuation. And those are the ones that are going to matter more than this relatively small subset of stocks that are very bubblicious.
Josh?
I opened my comments today by saying that Fastly is not important. It's not an important stock. It's not even in the S&P 500. The point that I'm trying to make, which I look at these things as a gauge on sentiment, and as a gauge specifically on the sentiment of the new investor that's come into this market in the last 6 months. And individually, they're not big portfolios, they're not institutions, but in the aggregate, they are a driving force behind multiple expansion across the entire market. They're most of the options activity. We know this empirically. It's an important contingent of investors that get affected by things like Fastly. Steve and Jim are wiser, more experienced. They're not caught up in these types of stocks. Great, great. But we're talking about the vast majority of investors who have been captivated by these stories. This is important. If you look at the Russell 3000, there are 416 companies that are losing money. The average return of these companies this year is 57%. It's outrageous. 100 of those 416 stocks are up over 100%. These are the stocks we're talking about. And some of them are very big. Some of them are way bigger than Fastly. So my point is, let's just keep an eye on responses in relatively small disappointments.
Right.
What the result is in the share prices, because to me, that's very telling of when the worm turns and people say, you know what, I don't want to own any of these stocks. They're not going up anymore. I only want to own them when they're going up.
Guys, the point that Josh is making is the point that I thought we were having a conversation about. Josh is, I think, exactly right. This is not about Fastly itself. Who cares in the bigger picture? I mean, if you're a shareholder today, I guess you do care. Company's obviously good at what it does. Ran up a lot. But it's a conversation about what could happen to sentiment for, as Josh said, a new class of investors who have helped push this market to where it is, Liz.
Yeah, so here's what I think it is. I think it's an indicator of where there might be vulnerability because of that type of investor. So if we see stress, like I opened the show with, for the next 30 days, maybe it's 60 days, whatever happens with the election, if we see stress, the first things to go are going to be stocks that people have the biggest gains in because they're easier to sell. They're more liquid. It's easier to sell something that you're up 80% in than it is to sell something that you're up 10% in. So there is some vulnerability in certain sectors, certain industry groups that have seen such euphoria through the year. But for the broader market, I don't think that necessarily changes the story. And I agree with, I think it was Jim who said it, it doesn't have to be contagious through every sector, but that individual investor is going to exacerbate moves on the upside and exacerbate moves on the downside because they're not at this point long-term traders.
I would say, Jim, that it potentially has the possibility of raising the bar for everybody in that group, if you will. Now you better knock it out of the park or you're going to get fast lead. You know, you're going to get you're going to get stiff armed and you're going to go flying like happened the other night. During the football game. Goldman today says it's time for value, that they go downgrade to tech to a neutral. They say it's the time for value. That's Peter Oppenheimer. He's their global chief equity strategist. Steve, what do you think about that?
I don't buy it. I think that we talk about value too much. Look, Cats had a big move. Deere's had a big move. They're typically in the value bucket. GE, we had announced come out and recommend GE last week. There's still growth in technology. We saw with Apple's announcement with 5G, what was lost is how that goes through the entire economy. 5G is going to add, according to Nokia, $8 trillion by 2030. That's in 8 years. According to Qualcomm, it's going to add $13 trillion by 2035. So growth in tech is still there. The Fastly's, the Snowflake. If that thesis were correct on Fastly, I'd say Snowflake would be down 10% today. Snowflake's down 2%.
No, because we need to
see. I'd take a look at Peloton and say it'd be down 20%.
Not everything. Not everything is going to go over the waterfall on the same day, and it may never. Right. You got to wait for the next one to see what they deliver. The point was made earlier, and I think you made it. that if such and such company delivered a great quarter, do you think they would be down? No, the answer is no. But Fastly couldn't meet the bar because the expectations had come up so high for a stock that's up better than 300% in a single year. Before we finish the segment, I want to get to another story.
And it should be whacked.
And it is getting whacked, but that doesn't mean that everything's going to or needs to today. You need more evidence before you're willing to get in the barrel and push it over the waterfall. The other story I want to get to quickly, because it's a growth value, it plays into value, obviously, is the airlines. And Jim Labenthal, you see what's happening to United today? Their CEO, Scott Kirby, after earnings, saying that the biz travel is not going to be back to normal, quote unquote normal, until 2024. Now, I know nobody owns United Airlines on this show. That stock's getting beaten down by 4%. Jim, you own Alaska, which is down as well. Who knows what's happening with stimulus? But this is yet another reminder that, and by the way, Wall Street got this right several months ago when it said, we're not coming back to normal in 3 to 5 years. That appears to be the case because the big money-making routes, biz travel, is done for at least right now.
Look, let me put it to you in this perspective, and I'll come back to Alaska in a second, but if you're looking at United, American, or Delta, you have to say to yourself, what fraction of profits for the next 5 years are going to be accumulated by you as the equity holder? And the answer is zero. The reason it's zero is because you are in a condition where you are taking out debt like crazy just to stay alive, and at the same time, you're shrinking your roots. You're shrinking your business. That is a recipe in which the stakeholders that matter are the debt holders, not the equity holders. So in those big three, you've got a big problem. Now, Alaska, and I don't want Alaska to overswamp what I just said. They have no net debt effectively, so that's a whole different story. That's not the focus. If you're looking at airlines, think about this. You've got cash burn, you've got debt levels going up astronomically, and you've got a shrinking business. That's not a place to invest as an equity holder.
Yeah, well, I mean, but you're in that stock. Are you having
which has no,
it's down four. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Go ahead. No, you go ahead. I apologize.
Well, yeah. So look, I don't think the airline industry is going away, and I'm willing to pick a winner on the other side. I think Alaska and Southwest are the two of them that will win by virtue of the fact that they basically have no balance sheet stress at all, basically no debt. Their cash burn is very close to zero. So, you know, that's where when the dust settles, you're going to see equity holders actually accumulating profits of a pie that for them is going to grow.
All right. We are going to take a quick break when we come back. It is a story that's getting a lot of buzz on the street today. What the Trump administration was reportedly telling some of its wealthy donors in private about the virus back in February while saying something different on this very network. Kate Kelly of The New York Times will join us next to discuss.
Old Dominion Freight Line was built on keeping promises. With an industry-leading on-time delivery record and low claims rate, we keep promises better than any other LTL freight carrier because we treat every shipment like it's our most important one. Visit odfl.com to learn more.
Welcome back. Show you stocks here, which may be taking a little bit of a turn lower and certainly worth keeping an eye on because I'm looking at the tape here and there is Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, has rejected a higher amount for COVID-19 stimulus, says his planned $500 billion bill is the appropriate response. That comes after the president, during an interview not that long ago this morning, suggested going higher than $1.8 trillion was the way that he wanted to go. So we'll continue to watch the major averages. Dow's down about 143 or so. Meantime, a new story in today's New York Times raising more questions about what the administration said publicly about the virus back in the winter versus what it was telling some in private. The piece's co-author, Kate Kelly, joins us now. Kate, good to see you.
Great to see you, Scott.
So this all stems from a meeting that a hedge fund consultant was at on February 25th, right? The very same day and only hours after Larry Kudlow said this on our network. We'll listen and I'll come back to you.
I just want to say, though, as far as the U.S. is concerned, when you look at this, I mean, you have a little higher headcount on the infections because of the cruise ship people coming off. We have contained this. We have contained this. I won't say airtight, but pretty close to airtight. We've done a good job in the United States. Hats off to our public health people.
So, Kate, based on your reporting, what happened after Larry Kudlow told our viewers that?
So about two and a half hours after that, Scott, he had a more private session with a board of overseers of the Hoover Institution, which is a conservative research organization housed within Stanford University. And he moderated those comments to say, we think it's airtight, we think it's contained, but we just don't know. So it was subtle in some ways, but it showed the ambiguity that he and others were dealing with at the time in a franker way than he said on Kelly's show that afternoon.
And you say what was actually said in that private meeting helped fuel the sell-off in stocks. Tell us how.
Well, there were a variety of things that happened at that Hoover meeting. So it took place over 3 days, Scott. It started with a keynote address on the Sunday night, February 23rd, with Mike Pompeo, Secretary of State. And at that point, you had a sell-off, as I'm sure your panel recalls. The market topped on February 19th. And after that, you saw some selling activity, but it really took off Monday the 24th, Tuesday the 25th, and into Wednesday the 26th. And so Kudlow was one of the meetings that sort of sparked some doubts among at least one apparently influential attendee who was at Hoover. You also had the Council of Economic Advisors, Tom Phillipson, who at the time was the acting chair, and others who were on a panel of that council talking about the economy. And one thing Phillipson did that was interesting was he declined to speculate on what GDP growth would be this year in light of the virus. Like, how is the virus going to impact GDP growth? Larry had said previously it would be 200 basis points, but in this setting, from what we're told, Phillipson said it's just too dynamic. I'm paraphrasing here, but it's just too dynamic. I really can't address it. I can't comment on it. That was another sort of tell for this person in the audience whose name was Bill Callanan, who wrote a memo about some of his findings during those 3 days in D.C. and some other one-on-one meetings he had had as well, including with a Democratic senator. He sent this email, sort of a very offhand type of memo. It's about 1,000 words long, but it's not a memo in the traditional sense. He sends this to David Tepper, the founder, of course, of Appaloosa Management, because Tepper and Callanan are in a dialogue at this point about what's going on with COVID. And we can talk a little more about Tepper's position on COVID. I'm sure we should get to that. But essentially, Tepper and at least one of his employees shared this with people they knew in the market. And separately, at the same time, Callanan had shared his findings with at least one client, separate from Tepper, who was not a client. And the word started getting around the market. And believe it or not, Scott, I first heard about this on February 26th, because it was that widespread at that point that one of my contacts called me and said, I worry that this is about to get ugly, and cited some things that person had heard from the memo.
You know how this works, right? You know, once a memo gets out, it sort of starts going around like wildfire, to your point, and sort of everybody gets their eyes on it. And I know you mentioned David Tepper, who I know you also know that I spoke to him last night, and he made the point that his view was already well-informed by the time that the memo went out. And if you recall, I'll read you his response right now. This is David Tepper to me. Last night, we were already concerned about the virus in January after reading the Lancet report and went on CNBC with a public warning. The information from the Hoover meeting meant little to us by the 24th. So, Kate, listen to David Tepper and what he told Jim Cramer at the very beginning of February, a conversation that was had on February 1st down in Miami where the Super Bowl was, and then aired on our network on February 3rd. Here's David Tepper speaking to Jim Cramer.
You have to be careful because it may be a game changer. So you just got to be cautious. And 2 weeks ago, before the virus, it was one thing, and it's a different environment right now. So that's what it is.
Right, Kate. And that's sort of Tepper's point. It's like, look, but by the time that memo or however it was relayed to him was brought up, he was already on top of the virus from the time he saw that Lancet article in January and started acting as such in terms of how he would be positioned.
Sure, Scott, I agree. And I've written about Tepper's position on coronavirus a couple of times. As a matter of fact, it was a conversation that David Solomon, the CEO of Goldman Sachs, had with David Tepper that very same weekend at the Super Bowl that made Solomon feel additionally worried about what was coming and really start looking at contingency plans for Goldman Sachs. So what you refer to is in our story. And I would say Tepper was one of the early cautionary voices on coronavirus. Absolutely. And I think, although I don't know the complete history between Tepper and this gentleman that wrote the email, Bill Callanan, that may have been part of the reason why they were dialoguing about COVID in the first place. As Tepper said to me when I spoke to him for this story, which I did a couple of times, you know, we were in the information flow at that point meaning late February. People were calling us, he told me, about COVID. We were calling other people to get information. He noted to me that he had been studying the fact that Milan Fashion Week was going on in late February at a time when virus cases were spiking in Italy. And he thought that was somewhat insane that, number one, that it was happening, but also that people hadn't seemed to take note of it. So I think all that context is important.
Well, he points to that, and sort of the administration's reaction is that he's sitting there watching all this traffic go back and forth between New York and Milan, where Fashion Week was, and says, you know, to himself, how in the world can this be happening? It speaks to what some term this lost month of February, where, you know, not much was certainly said publicly about worrying about the virus. Now, the Treasury Secretary was on the network this morning on Squawk Box. They asked him, Steve Mnuchin, about your story. Not surprisingly, perhaps, he took some shots at the New York Times. But let's listen to the Treasury Secretary, Kate, and I'll give you a chance to respond.
Okay.
Well, let me first say I saw the headline this morning. This is the first I've seen of it. It wouldn't be the first time I've seen a headline out of the New York Times that exaggerates things or puts them in a wrong perspective. I've had my own personal attacks from the New York Times doing this to me. I can't imagine this occurred. By the way, there were plenty of investors who had their own views of what was going on at the time.
I mean, Kate, maybe the biggest takeaway there is him saying, I can't imagine that this occurred. But the biggest takeaway to me from this whole story is yet another example we're learning through your reporting of an administration saying something in private versus what they said in public. This just happened to be a group of well-heeled donors and then investors that got the information that the public did not.
I think that's right. And if you think back to that time, everybody was so hungry for information. COVID was no secret. And as we've discussed, people like David Tepper, and I think also to a degree, Paul Singer, and actually during this very same time frame, Bill Ackman is putting on his derivatives position that effectively shorts the markets. So people were getting wise to it in the weeks prior to this period of time I'm writing about. But nobody knew what the outbreak would look like in the U.S. Nobody knew how bad it would be here and, or importantly, what the government was doing to prepare. Did they have the test kits available? Did the test kits work? Did they get useful data from China about the details of the virus's spread and how to create a test that would work and what the effective treatments were? And how were they telegraphing that to the American public for public health, first and foremost, but also so that people could make preparations as employers and as economic animals? So this was a period of time with a lot of muddiness. The market was ebullient, as you know, until February 19th. And at that point, and I've spent a lot of time talking to dozens of market participants about what their psychology was back then. And they've said, you know what? For the most part, it was a risk-on mentality. People didn't know how the elections would come out, but they at least wanted to take advantage of another year of a bull market under Trump. And the biggest worry out there, arguably, of course, because everyone has their own opinion, but was Bernie Sanders and his prominence in the Democratic primaries, followed by COVID, which was sort of a known unknown. So the fact that government officials, however subtly, were telegraphing that they were truly concerned was a departure from what the president was saying that very morning on Twitter and in other places in the days that preceded and followed, as well as a tonal difference from what Larry said on CNBC's air. Although it needs to be said, I interviewed Larry about this, and he said there was no intention to misinform, and he thought effectively what he said at the Hoover was similar to what he said to Kelly. So
obviously not, though, right? Because that wasn't the takeaway of the person, the consultant for the hedge funds who was in the room and came away with something completely different. And the ambiguity, as you mentioned already, that he thought was there. Let me bring Josh Brown in, Kate, if I could. He has a question for you.
Hey, Kate, isn't the real takeaway that investors, whether they're hedge fund managers or individual investors, should just consider the source of where they're getting information and understand that Larry Kudlow's job is not to be an infectious disease expert. His job is to put a spin on whatever the latest economic data is and make every day's market activity look favorable for the president. That's literally what his role is. It's not to tell people whether or not they should wear masks or whether or not they should be more concerned about the virus. So if we think about that and we think about how investors are treating the pronouncements that he's making, he was on TV yesterday on CNBC, like, don't people need to have their own level of responsibility for what they're going to do with their portfolio and take everything coming from a political source as being political and not wanting to upset the stock market?
Of course, Josh. And I think any investor worth their salt has their own thesis and their own algorithm. And I don't mean that in a literal sense, but their own sort of calculus for what inputs they're looking at and how those inputs are going to affect their overall market strategy. And I think that was at play here. I mean, there were people who received either the memo itself or descriptions of the memo from people they knew whose reaction was, oh, my God, short everything. And, you know, that in effect meant short the S&P and do other similar things. Some people who heard about it went out and bought toilet paper. Other people, and I've spoken to one macro style investor who received a readout of this briefing from Callinan and said, you know, it was an important input and it definitely affected my trading that week. But, you know, as a macro trader and an active trader, you're doing a lot of different things. You have your own worldview. This was one input. But it needs to be said, this was an array of senior administration officials, not Steve Mnuchin, so I'm not surprised he didn't know about it, but an array of senior administration officials making an array of comments. And for someone who was listening closely, like Bill Callinan, who worked at Soros Fund Management, Fortress, Key Square, and now has his own investment advisory group in London where he specializes in helping hedge funds set strategy. And by the way, his background is in studying China, Chinese economics, their impact on the supply chain, and so on. So if somebody with that background writes you a memo that says, as his did, and I'm paraphrasing here, but every single person we heard from listing, you know, a half dozen major people without being provoked brought up what a serious problem COVID was going to be. Mm-hmm. When you have that land in your inbox or when your phone rings with someone giving you even just a brief outtake of that, you're going to think, holy unmentionable. Like, I need to rethink here.
Yeah, no question. Or you can read The Lancet, of course, in January, right, as David Tepper did, and come to his own conclusion that this was going to be bad and I need to figure all this out and take cover. And he went on the air. He thought he had a responsibility to do that with Cramer on February 1st. We aired it on the 3rd because he did feel a responsibility. He doesn't do TV that often, which he made the point when I spoke to him last night, but thought this was important enough to go public with at least his concerns at those at that time. Kate, appreciate the conversation so much and enjoyed
Thank
the
you,
read
Scott.
As well. We'll talk to you again soon. That's Kate Kelly with The New York Times. Let's get the headlines now with Sue Herrera.
Scott, thank you very much. Here's what's happening at this hour, everyone. And we continue with news on COVID infections. New infections soaring in Italy. They reported cases jumped 20% from yesterday's record high, put it at more than 8,800 cases. Officials also reporting 83 deaths, nearly twice Wednesday's toll. But we should note, still well below the highs set in March and April. The Atlanta Falcons closing their training facility after another positive test by an unidentified person with the team. This Sunday's game against the Minnesota Vikings, though, remains on. A study sponsored by the Department of Defense shows the risk of COVID-19 transmission is extremely low on commercial aircraft. This even in planes that are full. And there's another study showing the risk of getting infected at the dentist may be very low. The American Dental Association surveyed nearly 2,000 dentists, and only 1% reported they had either tested positive or believed they had been infected. You are up to date, Scott. That's the news update this hour. I'll send it back to you.
And I appreciate that, Sue. Thank you, Sue Herrera. Up next, a wunderkind of startup investors. Dakin Sloss joins us of Prime Movers Lab. Who he's backed, what he's working on now, his thoughts on the hot SPAC market, and much more. Do not want to miss this interview.
What does it mean to be rich? Maybe it's less about reaching a magic number and more about discovering the magic in life. At Edward Jones, our dedicated financial advisors are the people you can count on for financial strategies that help support a life you love. Because the key to being rich is knowing what counts. Learn more about our comprehensive approach to planning at edwardjones.com/findyourrich. Edward Jones, member SIPC.
B2B selling is tougher than ever, and we feel your pain. If you're struggling to close deals, consider giving LinkedIn Sales Navigator a shot. This sales intelligence platform helps professionals like you engage high-value customers, drive higher revenue, and increase sales performance. Sales Navigator also guides you in targeting the right buyers, highlights key signals such as job changes or which accounts you should prioritize, and uncovers hidden hot prospects so you can find those buyers that are most likely to convert. Fueled by LinkedIn's 1 billion member platform, Sales Navigator gives you the most up-to-date first-party data, enabling you to unlock conversations with the people that matter. Right now, you can try LinkedIn Sales Navigator and get a 60-day free trial at linkedin.com/halftimereport. That is linkedin.com/halftimereport for a 60-day free trial. Let LinkedIn Sales Navigator help you sell like a superstar today. Just go to linkedin.com/halftimereport and get started.
Welcome back. Our next guest founded his first company at age 19 while at Stanford with Palantir co-founder Joe Lonsdale. A few years later, he started his second business in the oil and gas space and now is the founder and general partner of Prime Movers Lab. It's an early stage venture firm that invests in breakthrough scientific startups. Dakin Sloss joins us now. Welcome. Good to talk to you.
Thank you, Scott. I appreciate you having me on.
You have quite the resume. OpenGov with Lonsdale while at Stanford. Then you do Tachyus, where you're backed by Peter Thiel and the Schlumberger family in oil and gas. And now you're the co-founder of Prime Movers Lab. Tell us what Prime Movers Lab is and what kind of companies you're on the lookout for today.
Yeah, our mission is to invest in breakthrough scientific inventions that have the ability to transform billions of lives. These are technologies in energy, transportation, infrastructure, manufacturing, the future of computing, and human augmentation that can radically improve quality of human life and, as a result, produce phenomenal returns for our investors as well.
How big is your portfolio right now of companies?
Between the core portfolio and some of the smaller investments we've made, we've probably got about 24 companies spanning everything from space transportation to coronavirus vaccines to industrial solar heat, kind of across a broad spectrum.
Yeah. What's the investment environment like right now, just given where the markets are, the uncertainty that exists around the election, the volatility we're witnessing now? What do you see from an early stage investor standpoint?
Yeah, I was actually just reading Fred Wilson's blog post from Union Square Ventures, and in the last quarter, investment activity has been continuing to be at an all-time high in the early stage world. So venture is still doing business. Historically, like when you see concern in the markets, it takes longer to kind of get to the early stage portion of the markets. But the reality is we're at this unique moment in time where exponential technologies actually have the ability to radically reshape our entire civilization. And so I think it makes sense to be investing in those kinds of technologies, regardless of kind of global macro circumstances, which obviously have some concerning and uncertain times ahead.
Yeah. I mean, how does this happen? OpenGov at Stanford with Lonsdale. I mean, that's an interesting thing in and of itself, just because we've been talking about Palantir recently. Tachyus, I mentioned, is in oil and gas. Peter Thiel is a backer, along with the Schlumberger family as well. And then one of your portfolio companies, Heliogen, has Bill Gates as one of your co-investors. How does all this come together for someone so young as you?
Well, yeah, I think it doesn't have to do with me, to be frank. It has to do with surrounding yourself with people that are much better than you. You know, at OpenGov and at Tachyus and at Prime Movers Lab, I'm surrounded by teams of people that are much, much smarter than me, that are domain experts in the particular things that we invest in or the companies that we build. And, you know, you give credit to the kind of the person who's the face, but it doesn't have to do with me. It has to do with the much, much better people around me.
I would ask you sort of what you think of the current environment as it relates to technology and comparisons that are being made to 1999 in the dot-com bubble. But considering you're only like 10 years old then, I'm going to spare you that, since you have no recollection, I'm sure, of that whatsoever. But more recently, you do, I'm sure, have opinions on what's taking place with SPACs and what the message, if any, is about they're sending about the kind of investing that is going to deliver the biggest amount of alpha in the years ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I think the way people have talked about the SPAC story, particularly the last couple of weeks, with concern around fraud and Nikola and things like that, makes total sense. Anytime there's a new financial innovation, there's going to be, and I know it's not a new financial innovation, but a lot of activity around a financial innovation. There's going to be a lot of issues that pop up that have to be worked out. And this happens in the private markets as well, right? Like in private markets, people lose money on investments all the time. And it's a few big winners that make the difference. I think the much more positive take on the story is it's been a decade where all of the growth in the economy has been happening in private markets, and that hasn't been something that the average retail investor has had access to. And what SPACs are being used for right now is taking companies public at an earlier stage where there's definitely more risk, but there's way more upside and way more return as well. So I think it's an exciting time for the public markets to finally have access to growth stories again that can really drive meaningful returns and, you know, drive meaningful wealth in a broad-based distribution as well.
It's an interesting point you make, because when you look at, say, when you make your point, I'm thinking of immediately of Uber. And, you know, these late stage private companies that are so late stage, you clearly wonder how much growth is left by the time they go public. And now I'm thinking of an Airbnb, which isn't even public yet, falling into the same basket of the stories you're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, you've seen kind of late stage growth VC investors, which is generally, you know, like foundations, endowments, high net worth individuals, reaping a lot of the benefits of this growth. And they can continue to reap that benefit in the public markets. But the average guy hasn't actually had the opportunity to invest in these extraordinary technologies. Now, of course, again, they're high risk and people need to build a portfolio that's well diversified to manage that risk. But that's where the growth has been. That's where the economy has been. And if you look at the next decade, that's where the future is, right? I don't think you're going to see 10 years from now much of the Fortune 500 look the same. You're going to see new names, new faces that are radically reshaping the kinds of technologies we all rely on to live our lives.
How is COVID shaping the way you're investing in your portfolio companies, if at all?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting for us. We were actually a remote venture capital firm from day one. So we're a team of like a dozen people spread across the country. And, you know, people would ask us, like, how do you run a remote venture capital firm? I think everyone's kind of gotten it now. Like, remote work is a nice thing. It gives people a better quality of life. It gives us the ability to tap the best talent around the country, both for our team and for the founders that we're investing in. And it gives us a lot of flexibility to kind of just jump on a plane and go wherever we need to go. So frankly, COVID has not changed stuff for us. Obviously, it's been tough for many people, but we've been fortunate that we were kind of prepared.
Do you have anything in your portfolio that deals with COVID and with therapeutics, vaccines, anything of the like?
Yeah, we invested in COVAX, which is a coronavirus vaccine. They're using a synthetic peptide platform that is much safer, much more manufacturable, and from preclinical data has some of the best neutralizing antibody response of any of the vaccines in the market. They've been a little more under the radar, but I'd look out for them over the next couple months. They're going to be delivering 50 million plus doses in Q1. So it's an exciting time for the portfolio and mostly for what impact we can have in terms of helping to end this pandemic.
Where are they in terms of trials in the pipeline?
Yeah, so if you look them up, they're in their phase one in Taiwan, and then they're going to be going into phase twos in parallel in Taiwan, Brazil, and the U.S. In the coming months.
Interesting. Good to talk to you. Dakin, we'll catch up with you again soon. Be well.
Thank you so much for your time.
All right, that's Dakin Sloss joining us. Ahead, we're tracking the traders' latest moves. We're back right after this. All right, we're back. Steve Weiss, tell me about some of these moves that you are making in your portfolio. We've got a lot of action going on. Tell me.
Yeah, so based upon my thought process on the economy retreating somewhat and COVID becoming much more of a factor, I sold Micron. I sold the calls in the stock. As you recall, I said the stock trades between 46 and 50. I sold it yesterday at 51. I sold KSU. I'm concerned about the earnings. We talked about inflated multiples. That's there. I sold Albemarle and Lyondell also because, again, I'm worried about the economy. And I sold Cisco, which I had a tag-end position. I just think it's very tough. They're never going to make any real money for investors, so it's just not for me.
Oh, so don't tell
back
that to
the
Jim.
Trading positions.
Jim, you own Cisco
yeah,
still,
I
don't
I said it quickly, hoping
Scott,
hope
I sold
Jim
it.
Pay attention.
I sold
oh, you
it.
Sold, he sold
it's
that.
True.
It's Intel he's still holding on to, I think. Another, the other dog.
You're not going to let me skate away, huh?
Why would I? Why should I?
Hey, well,
why
okay.
should I?
Okay, let's get into it. All right. Jeez, we're having a moral conversation.
Well, Scott,
I just want to talk
Scott
about
this will make you feel
all
better.
All right, look. Go ahead,
Jim, quick.
Wait, look.
Let me just finish.
Really
Scott,
quickly.
Scott, if this will make you feel
I told
better,
you
I would have sold Intel.
Guys, go ahead, Jim, quick means Jim.
Yeah. Bottomed out at 47.50, just got back to 54 a couple of days ago. This thing will be in the mid-50s, the high 50s, and I'm out of it. I'm already looking at replacements. Stand by.
Okay. I've got more trades ahead. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. It's time for the futures outlook. The 10-year yield is lower. Jeff Kilberg of KKM Financial joins us now. 72 basis points, Jeff. And I think it was Mike Santoli who said earlier, market's starting to pay attention to what's happening on stimulus and also this pickup in cases, especially in Europe.
No, I think that's a great point, Scott. And the reason I'm bullish on future prices and bearish on yield, because I think we have a ceiling at 75 basis points, but the three real quick reasons why I'm bullish on these prices, bearish on yields, is due to the fact, first and foremost, the election uncertainty. Nothing feels and tastes better than buying some treasuries with that uncertainty. We also see a range-bound market, but lastly, it just seems to really be that the German bund. It hit a recent month low at minus 62 basis points. So, Scott, the 10-year note at 72 basis points is quite juicy. So I want to be a buyer here in the December contract, 139.06, looking for a move higher to 140.06. However, I'm being mindful, using a stop just 16 ticks lower at 138.22. I'm risking $500, Scott, to make $1,000.
All right. We'll see what happens. Jeff, thank you. Final trades are straight ahead. The CNBC FA Summit is bringing together the country's top advisory firms to explore the state of the markets. You can join Jay Clayton, Mario Gabelli, our own Josh Brown, and more to discover new ways to address the increasingly complex needs of your clients. Go to cnbcevents.com/FA Summit to register. The summit takes place on October 20th. All right, Liz Young, final trades. What you got?
Not the highest octane one I've ever used, but municipal bonds, in the sense that a prospect for higher taxes makes them attractive. Any fiscal package that includes state and local aid is another boost.
All right. I got to go to Jim Labenthal, of course. Labenthal, Labenthal, and Labenthal after that.
I love that. Thank you, Liz. Caterpillar's my final trade. Okay. Great bid to it.
All right. Steve Weiss, quickly.
Taiwan Semi, great quarter. All right. And
Josh,
guide.
Name?
Long, J.P. Morgan.
All right. Thanks, everybody. The exchange is now.
You've been listening to CNBC's Halftime Report, the podcast. You can always catch us live weekdays at 12 Eastern, only on CNBC.
The spirit of performance defines Acura. And now it's electric. Introducing the all-electric ZDX, Acura's most powerful SUV yet. While what powers their cars may change, the energy that makes Acura never will. Crafted using the same formula that brought them electrified supercars and multiple IMSA championships, the ZDX has track-tested performance that packs an energy all its own. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system and up to 313-mile range on a single charge, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is everything they said electric could never be. It was built with the driver in mind, just like Acura has been doing since the beginning. We could talk all day, but the only way to experience this electric performance is to drive it yourself. Unlock the energy and order yours at Acura.com.